Support for STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, comes from Ortho McNeil Neurologics Incorporated, exploring the neurological needs of patients and caregivers today, tomorrow, and in the future.
Welcome to STAT, the inaugural podcast of Clinical Neurology News, with the latest advancements in neurology and medicine. In this half hour, we'll focus on insights into neurological diseases, with reports on TPA, risk of hemorrhage not increased in older stroke victims.
The older patients had no more intracerebral or systemic hemorrhages than the younger patients after receiving thrombolysis for their strokes.
Silent strokes in teens with sickle cell.
In the stroke prevention trial in sickle cell anemia, transfusion therapy was associated with a 90% reduction and stroke risk over a 3-year period.
Shocking treatments for spinal cord injuries.
The contractions are sequenced by a computer to generate purposeful motion of the legs to pedal a stationary leg cycle.
And our case file, the empirical method. How we stop seizures today and learn to embrace medicine.
Man can learn nothing except by going from the known to the unknown.
This is STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, the independent source for neurology professionals. I'm Marty Goldenson. As you listen to this podcast in your office, at home, or on the road, remember you can get the complete stories in Clinical Neurology News at clinicalneurologynews.com. You can also find all of our STAT neurology podcasts online for free at medicalnewspodcast.com. This week's lead story, use of clot busters in embolic stroke patients over 80 does not increase risk of hemorrhage. We heard about a man who had a stroke last year at the age of 82. The doctors decided against using TPA, tissue plasminogen activator, for fear that it might cause bleeding in his brain. Our story provides insight into using these clotbuster drugs to treat older stroke patients. Dr. Campbell Douglas joins me to report.
Marty, some centers may be less likely to offer thrombolytic therapy in very elderly patients due to a perceived heightened risk of hemorrhage. But according to a study by neurologist Bart DeMarshall and his associates, withholding this therapy from those patients is not warranted.
And how did they determine this?
At the Mayo Clinic Hospital in Scottsdale, Arizona, 70 patients were studied, 50 were younger than 80, and 20 were old, defined as 80 or older. Each patient received tissue plasminogen activator, TPA, within 3 hours of experiencing acute ischemic stroke. Then, the outcomes of the octogenarians and the nonagenarians, the 90-year-olds, were compared to the patients younger than 80.
And they found...
The older patients had no more intracerebral or systemic hemorrhages than the younger patients after receiving thrombolysis for their strokes. It's worth noting that the patients over 80 had more asymptomatic petechial hemorrhages in the zone of infarction on 24-hour CT scans. These were seen in 6 of the 20 patients over 80, but in just 1 of the 50 patients less than 80 years of age.
So, no increase in overt bleeds. But what about other short and long-term outcomes for 80 and 90-year-olds?
In both age groups, half of the patients achieved a 4-point or greater improvement in the National Institute of Health stroke scale 24 hours after receiving TPA. So short-term outcomes were equal in the two groups.
And long-term?
The older patients did have significantly more disability than the younger ones, 16% compared with 8% for the younger patients, measured by the modified Rankin scale, but the older patients were also far more likely to have a disability that predated their strokes and to have suffered more severe strokes.
So the bottom line is...
Older and younger thrombolyzed stroke patients respond well immediately to TPA and have a comparable hemorrhage rate, but the poorest prognosis goes to the thrombolyzed octogenarians.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell Douglas. Dr. DeMarshall's research was presented at the annual meeting of the American Neurological Association in San Diego. We'll be interviewing Dr. DeMarshall about this work in weeks to come, but you can find Betsy Bates' article on it in the December 2005 issue of Clinical Neurology News. Thrombolyzed octogenarians. Sounds like the name of a rock band. So that's strokes in adults, but here's a question for you listeners. What young population has a high incidence of strokes? A report with great optimism for that difficult circumstance is coming up. But first, you're listening to STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, the independent news source for neurology professionals. I'm Marty Goldenson.
Support for STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, comes from Ortho McNeil Neurologics Incorporated, exploring the neurological needs of patients and caregivers today, tomorrow, and in the future.
Surprisingly, about 20% of children with sickle cell disease will experience silent cerebral infarcts by the time they turn 14.
I'm surprised, but according to neurologist E. Stephen Roach at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, strokes are possibly the most severe complication of sickle cell and the least recognized. He's working on the diagnosis and treatment of these silent cripplers. Nurse practitioner Heather Wise joins us with the details. Why are kids with sickle cell disease prone to strokes?
The problem is the sickle-shaped blood cells. They don't flow through tiny blood vessels as they should and can block blood flow to the brain, resulting in stroke. And if small enough regions of the brain are affected, there may be no immediate overt signs or symptoms. That's where silent comes in. But as Dr. Roach finds, the neurologic impact of silent strokes in children with sickle cell disease is anything but silent. These strokes can cause attention difficulties, forgetfulness, and ultimately a lower IQ.
I guess you'd look for significant declines in school performance.
Absolutely. Dr. Roach said one of the telltale signs that these children have suffered silent stroke is that they start failing in school. And worse, the kids who have silent infarcts have about a 25% risk of additional silent strokes or overt symptomatic ischemic strokes within 3 years. Fortunately, transfusion therapy is showing promise, but the silent infarcts are dangerously underrecognized as a real complication of sickle cell disease. And like many diagnoses in medicine, you typically don't recognize silent infarcts unless you're looking for them or looking for something else and happen to notice a lesion.
Detective work needed. So, Dr. Watson, how are doctors to detect silent strokes more often in this 20% of sickle cell patients?
That's where the wonders of medical imaging come in, especially ultrasound and MRIs. They're even defining diseases now. Dr. Roach said for most purposes, a silent cerebral infarct is defined as an abnormal magnetic resonance image of the brain with increased signal intensity in multiple T2-weighted images in someone with no focal neurologic deficit after 24 hours.
That last forkful flew right over my head.
Point is, MRIs allow us to detect many of these children who've had silent strokes.
Okay, you mentioned the transfusion therapy as treatment.
The clinical results appear really promising. Get this, in the stroke prevention trial in sickle cell anemia, transfusion therapy was associated with a 90% reduction in stroke risk over a 3-year period. That's pretty impressive, and more studies are on the way. This preventive therapy makes it all the more important to identify children at risk. Early detection and treatment can beget happier patients, families, and neurologists.
Thank you, nurse practitioner Heather Wise. Maybe we'll soon see a treatment protocol established. This story was written by Diana Mahoney. You can see the remarkable MRI images which accompany her story on silent strokes at clinicalneurologynews.com. Our IT staff tells us that in the not-too-distant future, we'll be able to include both images and video with our podcasts, but right now, we have it in sound. This is STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, the independent news source for the neurology professional. Just ahead, The Briefing, our weekly audio roundup of neurology news with promising therapies and insights. Parkinson's disease is a significant part of most neurology practices. Dr. Campbell Douglas reports on a study that may give doctors a new incentive to get their Parkinson's patients to hit the gym.
Marty, creatine is a substance discovered in meat in the 1800s by French scientist Michel Eugène Chevreul. Many athletes take creatine as a bodybuilding supplement, and research does seem to support it as an ergogenic, if used carefully. There's a compelling study showing that creatine boosts the benefit of exercise in Parkinson's patients. Creatine's benefits may be related to its ability to reduce the depletion of adenosine triphosphate, ATP, during exercise and stimulate protein synthesis. Also, in a study published in Experimental Neurology 1999, creatine preserved dopaminergic neurons in a mouse model of Parkinson's. Now that's intriguing. Dr. Chris Haas at Columbia University, New York, found in a randomized blinded study that patients with idiopathic Parkinson's disease given creatine in combination with resistance training appeared to have increased strength and endurance. In his study, 20 patients underwent progressive resistance training on exercise machines. Half took 5 grams of creatine per day. The other half got a placebo. 11 different exercises focusing on arms, legs, torso, and back were done. After 12 weeks, both groups could lift more weight, but the creatine group improved significantly more than the placebo group. For example, they had more than double the improvement in biceps curls, and leg extension endurance increased by 95% for patients taking creatine, which was 30% more than those taking placebo.
So, supplementing exercise programs for Parkinson's patients with creatine can significantly boost the impact?
Sure looks like it, Marty. It may be too early to include creatine in clinical practice guidelines for Parkinson's, but if any listeners know of guidelines which do include it, please email us. We'd like to know.
That address is feedback@medicalnewspodcast.com. Thanks, Dr. Douglas. Next, new research in restorative therapy for patients with chronic spinal cord injuries. 10 years ago, actor Christopher Reeve fell from a horse and was paralyzed from the neck down. A tireless fighter, he underwent treatment involving electrical stimulation and eventually became a powerful spokesman for the therapy. Even after Reeve's recent death, there's more hope and new research around the treatment. 11,000 Americans experience traumatic spinal cord injury each year, and it looks like electrical treatments could improve their neurological functioning and muscular integrity. Neurologist Ralph Zwolinski is here with the details.
The research was reported at the annual meeting of the American Neurological Association in San Diego, Marty. Dr. John W. McDonald and Associates at Washington University in St. Louis and Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore studied about 60 adults whose spinal cord injuries occurred at least 1 year prior to the study. 26 patients undergoing restorative therapy, including at least 3 hours of functional electrical stimulation, cycle ergometry, each week for 6 months or longer, were compared with 22 patients who spent a similar length of time but received only traditional therapy.
And what is functional electrical stimulation?
This is therapy using transcutaneous electric current to stimulate muscle contractions in paralyzed lower extremities. The contractions are sequenced by a computer to generate purposeful motion of the legs to pedal a stationary leg cycle.
This is sort of animatronics meets 21st century medicine.
Could be a headline, Marty. Each of these ergometry electrical devices has a program cartridge available only by prescription that is set for the specific individual needs of each patient, with such things as duration of the treatment and the timing of electrical impulses to the muscles.
And what was the upshot for the patients?
70% of the patients responded to this therapy. Their stimulated muscles increased strength by 80%, and spasticity was reduced by half. In fact, 40% of patients undergoing electrical stimulation were able to decrease the use of the antispasticity agent baclofen or discontinue it altogether. And of the patients receiving traditional therapy without electrical stimulation, only 15% of them could reduce or discontinue the antispasmodics.
Very encouraging. I remember hearing someone say that medicine will advance significantly as it catches up with modern physics and electronics.
A long journey starts with a single step, and this was a pilot study, Marty. But Dr. McDonald says a randomized trial with 400 patients is scheduled for this year.
The insights keep coming. Our third new treatment, in fact, does call on modern physics, as radiotherapy targets acoustic neuromas. As a radio journalist and a lover of all things audio, I value my ears. I know that sometimes people who suffer from middle ear tumors, acoustic neuromas, have a high rate of nerve damage from surgery. So I'm anxious to hear this report on radiation treatment that substantially reduces this risk. Nurse practitioner Heather Wise, this is an X-rated story.
You could say that, Marty. It's all about powerful emissions of energy. In the past, treatment for acoustic neuromas was mostly in the hands of surgeons only, but surgery for these tumors is associated with a very high rate of facial motor nerve and sensory nerve damage, even over 50% in some reports. Dr. Stephanie Combs of the University of Heidelberg, Germany, is using a revolutionary alternative, linear accelerator-based fractionated stereotactic radiotherapy, or FSRT, and the data is showing excellent control of acoustic neuromas with few or no complications. In her 100 patients, the rate of new onset facial nerve dysfunction after FSRT was only 2%. That's a lot less than the 50% or more that you might see with the direct surgical approach. Tumor control after FSRT was essentially 95% at 3 years and 5 years, regardless of patient age, tumor size, or the presence of neurofibromatosis, a frequently associated condition. And Marty, more good news for you and for other audio journalists is that of the patients with serviceable hearing prior to FSRT, 95% maintained useful hearing at 5 years.
Another frontier for stereotactic radiosurgery. Thanks, nurse practitioner Heather Wise. The original story on acoustic neuromas was written by Bruce Jansen for Clinical Neurology News. And that's this week's Stat Neurology Briefing. Stat podcasts are created exclusively to serve neurologists and neurology healthcare professionals. We welcome your comments to feedback@medicalnewspodcast.com. Up next, our case file. To stop a patient seizing in the ER, are doctors relying on personal experience or actual clinical practice guidelines, or both? This is STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, the independent news source for neurology professionals. I'm Marty Goldenson.
Support for STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, comes from Ortho McNeil Neurologics Incorporated, exploring the neurological needs of patients and caregivers today, tomorrow, and in the future.
We're joined again now by Dr. Campbell Douglas.
Marty, a recent article in Clinical Neurology News seized upon an issue that really confounds doctors. It was written by Timothy F. Kern, titled Empiric Therapy the Rule in Status Epilepticus.
Okay, status epilepticus, that means epileptic state. But empiric therapy? The dictionary defines empiric as one who is guided by practical experience rather than precepts or theory. I thought you guys always treated by established protocols.
Marty, it's probably best to never say always and never say never when it comes to the practice of medicine. Timothy Kern reports on a presentation given by Dr. Elko Vadex at a meeting on high-risk emergency medicine sponsored by the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Vadex stressed that in the emergency department, when the physician is faced with the need for acute treatment of status epilepticus, he needs to remember that in these cases, second-line treatment is more empiric, that is, based on personal experience, rather than by sanctioned medical guidelines.
So you're each working out your own methods as you go along? But hey, you know, Camp, the second definition listed here for empiric is an unqualified or dishonest practitioner, a charlatan.
Well, Marty, with public perceptions of medicine and malpractice the way it is, that's apparently the charge we're sometimes open to. But what you have to understand is that there are limits to what is scientifically known. As Dr. Vadex himself stated, the first drugs of choice to treat epileptic seizures are lorazepam and fosphenytoin. But if they fail to stop the seizures, the next step is unknown. Fortunately, most seizure patients respond to these first-line medications, but non-responsive seizure patients remind any doctor of what English physician William Harvey said, "All we know is still infinitely less than all that remains unknown."
So what would the ER doc do in this situation?
7 years ago, I might have answered phenytoin, phenobarbital, and diazepam, followed by phenytoin again. But this regimen has already largely fallen from first-line use. Again, we're practicing in the realm of the unknown. Dr. Vadex emphasized that there's no data suggesting which agent should be used after lorazepam and fosphenytoin in refractory seizure cases.
Well, what would Dr. Vadex do?
He prefers intravenous valproate as a bolus, then infusion, because it doesn't affect blood pressure and carries less risk than barbiturates. But barbiturates are very effective. Surveys suggest that about half of experts would use a barbiturate as the third-line agent. Surveys also indicate that many physicians report using midazolam or propofol in these non-responsive seizure patients.
And for a treatment of last resort, what could be used?
By the time you've administered all those medications and the patient is still seizing, you've consumed significant amounts of the patient's time. Possibly the last cards up the doctor's sleeve at that point include lidocaine and ketamine.
So say you get the seizure under control, and then I presume you continue medications for some period, but for exactly how long?
Not to sound repetitive, Marty, but exact answers are also relatively unlikely in medicine, except at the exact time of birth and death. In fact, there's absolutely no data indicating how long anti-seizure medication should be continued.
There's an annoying whisper of uncertainty starting to bother me, Camp.
That's the world of medicine. Physicians do the best they can in the realm of endless questions and differential diagnoses. My first lecture in medical school was titled Training for Uncertainty. There's only so much a school can do to train for that.
Okay, well, how long does the Mayo Clinic treat the patient whose seizure is now under control?
Dr. Vadex said the practice there is to continue treatment for only 6 to 8 hours if seizures are controlled with lorazepam and fosphenytoin. Then dosages are titrated back at 10% an hour unless seizures reappear, in which case they return to the dosage that achieved control in the first place and try again.
Wow, my hat's off to neurologists wading in that undulating quagmire of uncertainty.
To wrap it up, I want to quote another medical great, French physiologist Claude Bernard, who said, "Man can learn nothing except by going from the known to the unknown." And there's the corrective to your annoying sense of uncertainty. Jump into the unknown. But that's probably not the aid you're looking for. For what it's worth, I'm convinced that exciting challenges and disagreeable stressors are two sides of the same coin we call medicine.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell Douglas, with our STAT case file. And to writer Timothy Kieran and Dr. Vadex, who directs the Critical Care Neurology Division at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Next week, Medicines with Merit. We'll report on pharmaceuticals showing promise for neurological problems. Don't forget that the content you hear on STAT comes from Clinical Neurology News, the independent news source for neurology professionals. You can find these reports in print and many more at clinicalneurologynews.com. And now, doctors, hang on to your tuning forks because it's rapid fire. And here with our quick list of developments in neurology is nurse practitioner Heather Wise.
Restless leg patients may need treatment for depression. In this study, on over 1,000 patients, those with RLS were 3 times more likely to have a major depressive disorder. Reducing homocysteine doesn't cut cardiovascular risk. In the Norwegian vitamin trial called Norvit, B6 and folate decreased homocysteine, but not MIs or strokes. One doctor boldly stated, "The homocysteine hypothesis is dead." And genetic fingerprints of stroke may hold the keys to intervention. The notion that genomic expression can provide a fingerprint of a disease is increasingly proving true. Patterns of gene expression in blood samples can now identify patients with early ischemic stroke, the majority within 3 hours, and probably all within 24 hours of the event.
I'll look forward to hearing more about that.
In other news, a multiple sclerosis study points to chromosome 6. A large genetic linkage study pinpointed the major histocompatibility complex on the short arm of chromosome 6 as the key genetic player in multiple sclerosis. And more news on MS. Changes to the most widely used diagnostic criteria for MS, the McDonald criteria, strengthen the role of magnetic resonance imaging as a diagnostic tool and eliminate abnormal spinal fluid as a necessary finding to diagnose the disease. This should speed up diagnosis without sacrificing accuracy. And finally, CT angiography ready for prime time. In screening for blunt cervical vascular and cerebrovascular injuries, computed tomographic angiography with 16-channel detector had a positive predictive value of 100% and negative predictive value of 98.9%. The riskier catheter arteriography still remains the gold standard in many centers, but with stats like these, I doubt arteriography will be diagnostic numero uno for long.
Thanks, Ms. Wise. You can take a break here, rest up for next week's Rapid Fire. And last but not least in our stat podcast, acupuncture. It seems that the verdict is still out on acupuncture. Yes, the Chinese have used it for centuries, and a friend of mine swears that lying on a table with lots of needles in him actually soothed his sciatica and saved his marriage, a cure-all. But a recent study from the Archives of Internal Medicine says acupuncture equals sham in stroke patients. Michelle G. Sullivan reports that acupuncture did not improve functional recovery or health-related quality of life in stroke patients. Dr. Younghae Park and associates randomized 115 patients, less than 4 weeks from stroke onset, to receive either real acupuncture or sham treatments for 2 weeks. By the end of the treatment period, both groups had improved significantly and similarly. Interestingly, though, a post hoc secondary analysis indicated that among the most severely affected patients, those in the acupuncture group had greater improvement in leg function than those in the sham group. What's all this mean? We'll probably keep on using and testing acupuncture for another few centuries, in the midst of uncertainty, that is. Happy New Year 2006. We hope this inaugural episode of our STAT podcast helped you to catch up with developments and therapies in neurology. Next week, Medicines with Merit, focusing on epilepsy and seizures. I'm Marty Goldenson. I hope you'll join us. STAT is the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, the independent news source for neurology professionals. A co-production of Flow Productions, Murray Street, and International Medical News Group, they are solely responsible for its content. Written by Dr. William Campbell Douglas. Editors Lauren Krenzel and Steve Rath. Information Technology, Calvin Simmons. STAT content is based on Clinical Neurology News, a copyrighted publication of Elsevier International Medical News Group. We invite your comments on issues in this podcast or in your practice. Please refer to STAT episode number 1 and email feedback@medicalnewspodcast.com. Include a daytime phone number and tell us how to pronounce your name. You can download STAT at medicalnewspodcast.com or set iTunes Media Player and your iPod to download STAT automatically using the feed www.medicalnewspodcast.com/cnn.xml. That's our site, and that's our program for this week. If you invite us, we'll be back in your ears next week with more clinical neurology news for the 21st century. For STAT, I'm Marty Goldenson. STAT Podcast is a copyrighted production of International Medical News Group and Flow Productions, copyright 2006.
Support for STAT, the podcast of clinical neurology news, comes from Ortho McNeil Neurologics Incorporated, exploring the neurological needs of patients and caregivers today, tomorrow, and in the future.